Hello, Steve.
Hello, mate.
Today we're talking with Steve Ellis, Love Affair. Tell us how you started out, Steve. Just 15, you formed the Soul Survivors in the year England won the World Cup. Do you remember much about that?
What, the World Cup?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course I do, yeah.
What about the Soul Survivors, though?
We were at school, and there was an advert in the Melody Maker, I think it was, or the NME. And my friend, I was in a gang of about 12 of us, we grew up together, you know. And one of them, Nigel, my mate, played the guitar, and he said, oh, I'll put you down for this audition. I went, what? So anyway, he dragged me off. I wanted to pretend he was going to audition for guitar, but he thought better of it and decided he wasn't going to do it. So I got there under false pretenses, basically, and I got the job. So.
And a year later, of course, you were in the limelight with Love Affair singing Everlasting Love.
Yep. The thing was at school, and then we started out and we were rubbish. But we rehearsed a lot in a factory in Tottenham and in Walthamstow, and we got better and we played everywhere. Everywhere. We worked our way up through the clubs. And we ended up playing all the usuals up north, Torch, Tunstall, getting back at 5 in the morning, and Mum going, where the hell have you been? Manchester or whatever, Stoke or whatever, and bashing me across the head with a broom, you know, standing behind the door at 5 in the morning, where you been? And then we did residencies at the Marquee, and we even did Flamingo, all the clubs in London, and we were kids. Flamingo, it's a very famous club.
Yeah.
And they said that whatever you do, don't tell them how old you are because we'll lose our licence. And then we'd shuttle out of there at 3 in the morning and go home, get up and go back to school.
Having watched your video for Everlasting Love many times, I remember there was a girl like Charlie Chaplin and a stunner, which I think I'm still in love with.
Why is everybody dribbling about this girl? I mean, who's the girl? Not the Charlie Chaplin one, the other one. Yeah.
But who were they and what?
Not a clue. The faintest idea. The one with a hat on and the Charlie Chaplin-esque one, was the presenter, is apparently quite famous in whatever country it was because we played all over Europe. I can't even remember where it was.
No.
And the other girl was just a dancer.
I mean, you look so young there, Steve, don't you?
Well, it was.
I know. To get a hit like that at that age, I mean, did you ever think you'd get it that quickly?
No, we made one before that. For Decca, the dreadful cover version of a Rolling Stones number called She Smiled Sweetly, which was in the wrong key. I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about singing when I was 16.
Yeah.
And we trundled off to the BBC and gave it to Tony Blackburn, and he played it, bless him. But it was dire. It was dire. And been mates with Tony Blackburn ever since. Like a really good guy. Well, very knowledgeable man on soul music.
Yes. I mean, the Love Affair were made up of session singers at the time. I mean, do you wish you'd had a regular band behind you?
Well, it is what it is, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of a double-edged sword. You know, managers do what managers do. Went in the studio at Ireland with Muff Winwood producing. Never heard it since. Can't remember. Don't know if it ever existed thereafter in any shape or form. It was deemed not good enough by the band playing it. Although the band was, you know, good. Let's face it, the band was good because we went out and played everywhere. But it wasn't the right kind of a sound because they wanted this kind of big, fat, orchestrated thing. So I ended up in the studio with, like, Clem Cattini and all those guys, session players. Not session singers, session players. I'm like, where's my band, you know? But, yeah, it was good. Did it in 2 takes, Mike Smith producing.
Hearts gone astray, deep in hurt when they go. I went away just when you need me so. You won't regret, I've come back begging you. Won't you forget, welcome love.
Two takes, is that all?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you've gone on record that due to the band not making it big in the US is why you decided to leave the band in 1969. But would that be accurate?
It's absolute rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. It was in the press. I don't know why they put it. Managers again. Managers do what managers do. We're too busy running around playing everywhere in the country. And they say, oh, Love Affair tour, USA, blah, 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 blah. Well, nobody ever mentioned it to me. And then there was this thing that I left because we didn't tour America. That's total fabrication. I left because, in essence, the music couldn't be heard because we turned into this sort of teen band.
Right.
And we were playing and we were good. You You know, we played with the Who, we played with everybody, you know, we played with Free, Who, you name it. We Moody Blues,
yeah,
Floyd, you name them. We never got troubled. We went down really well. But then when it kicked into this sort of mania with girls, you couldn't hear anything. You didn't have 20,000 watt PAs in. It was like 200 watts. If you had 200 watt PA, you were king of the world. But you couldn't hear anything. You know, what's the point? Like, you know, I'm a musician. I make music. That's what I do. So
I think John Lennon was half the reason. That was the reason why they felt that the end of the band was there, because of the screaming and all that.
Maybe. I don't know. I couldn't answer that, you know.
But talking of the Who, the death of Keith Moon deeply affected you. I mean, you decided to give up the booze. Tell us about that event and how it made you change your life around, Steve.
Well, because he's my pal, you know, and we get crazy like everybody did back in those days. And I had great times, he's a great guy. And tragic death. And I just thought, well, he had nine lives, you know. And I just thought, well, if it can happen to Keith, it can happen to me. It can happen to any of us, really. So I just threw it in, packed it in.
Then in the early 70s, you've done a bit of stuff with Zoot Money, I believe.
Yeah, it's all still my pal, talented guy, love him a bit, 78 now.
And still performing as well.
Yep, just did a tour, he's just Ronnie Scott's a couple of weeks ago with Georgia Fame for a week.
Yeah.
Now, Zoot's like one of my best pals. He's sort of, as soon as he heard I wasn't well the other month, he phoned me up straight away. We get on the phone and we don't get off the phone for about an hour because we end up laughing so much. I've been in the band in 2-3 years.
Yeah.
You know, I played on other albums I've done, you know, need a keyboard, so I'll get George in, that's his real name, George Avarone Normani. I'll get George in for keys, and he's just my pal, you know, I love him to bits.
Yeah. And you've also formed a close bond with Paul Weller. I mean, you were one of his idols, weren't you?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as saying that.
Well, I think you said that.
It's not for me to say.
Yeah.
He's my mate, I mean.
Yeah.
I sent him some tapes back in Style Council days, and went up to the studio in London to meet him with my daughter, who was a bit of a fan of the Jam, and got on really well with him, and was just stayed mates ever since, best pals. You know, in the music business, it's fickle, you know, but I've got some constants, you know, Zoo, Paul, you know, and a good few others, but that's all I can tell you about that, really. I wouldn't say he was a fan. I think he likes the Love Affair records, and we did an album together, Boom Bang Twang.
Going back as a child, I mean, who were your musical idols, Steve?
Ray Charles was a Black Blind singer, as you know. I used to watch him on black and white TV when we had like two channels on a Sunday in the front room. I don't know, it might have been London Palladium or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, I thought he was brilliant. When I started singing, I sort of tried to copy him for quite a long time and then thought, I didn't know what my voice would be, what it was. You know, you haven't got a clue when you're 15, you know.
No.
So you sort of work on it and then you find your own voice, you know, in the end. So he was like a big influence on me. And then, of course, you know, all the obvious ones, all the Bobby Blue Band, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave. You go on forever with them.
Yeah, you can.
Black Soul singers were the ones that ticked the box for me, American Black Soul singers, because I was a mod. Mods love soul music, especially black R&B and soul and blues, you know, so even a bit of blues, you know, sort of getting into all the roots of the blues and everything, you know.
Yeah, I mean, would you call yourself a mod or a soul boy?
Well, Paul's got this saying, bury me a mod, you know, Paul says bury me a mod. I think that whole mod thing has just been overcooked, overdone, and it isn't what it was. It was of its time, but in essence, you do kind of carry it through with you, because it's like, without analysing the whole thing, jealousy, you know, etc., etc. And it's part of your fabric of your life. And I kind of kept that through the years. Yeah, I like to look smart on stage, and otherwise I just sort of incognito, really. I don't sort of walk about like a peacock. You know, people come to see you play. I've done all that jeans and T-shirt, you know, Widowmaker when I was in the Widowmaker, you know. But there were different days, the 70s, you know, rock and roll, rock band, whatever.
Yeah. Last album, Boom Bang Twang, a lot of airplay on the radio.
But it did very well. The record label were very happy with it, you know.
How did the album come about?
Right, Paul sent me a track to work on a couple of years ago now, sort of a bluesy thing, and I wrote some more words for it and changed it about and so on and so forth. And then I was up to his studio because he had the backing track down, and we changed it all around a bit. And then he said, well, why don't you do your album here? And he'd offered it me before, 3-4 times probably, but I'd either been touring, he'd been touring, whatever. So we sort of co-produced with Charles, who works there permanent, so between the three of us sort of thing. When Paul was out touring or whatever, I carried on with Charles, and we had, in essence, mainly members of Paul's band, like Ben Gordelia, drummer, is my mate, he's great, Andy Crofts, and also, you know, there was a bit of a mixture of people all across it, really. Steve Craddock's on it by default because he played on that track, but he wasn't actually there when I was there. And he's a mate, Steve's a good lad. Some ideas, my own songs, etc., etc. And I did a band that I really like called Cow. While I was there doing the one that Paul and I sort of knocked up, I actually did the one that I did with Cow because they were working there as such as well. Yeah, Cow's got just done a new album actually. I'm waiting to hear it. They're good people. Wheels within wheels, and people get on, you know. It's all about music, and they're all of a like mind, and there's no egos hurtling about, and nobody's giving it all, you know.
Yeah.
Follow the leader, right, got an idea. But I like the way Paul works. It's like, if somebody's got an idea, he just goes to get it, do it, or whatever. There's nobody in charge. It's not organised chaos. It's like, you go with it, you know, yeah. You go with it. If it's a bad idea, scrap it, but at least it was worth trying.
Sure.
You know, did a record store day, double A-side, did a double A-side with Cow, vinyls, these are vinyls, did a box set, like, beginning of the year, I think, 10 CD box set, yeah, that was a job of work, that took a
Whoa.
Year. I'm doing a new album, started a new album, yeah, I've got 3 down, it is what it is, just so it goes, you know.
Steve Ellis, lovely talking with you today.
A pleasure, mate.